Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in sunny San Francisco.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. For the first time in podcast history, there is not a Kennedy in the U.S. Senate.
And no real prospect for a new generation of Kennedy leadership. First, we want to look back, though, to when we last had no Kennedy in the United States Senate.
Well, actually, the last time we had no Kennedy in the U.S. Senate was early 1962. As you well remember, John F. Kennedy was elected president.
As you well remember, Ken.
That's right. John F. Kennedy was elected. Actually, Richard Nixon was elected, but they stole the election because of Catherine Harris. And so John F. Kennedy, when he was elected president in 1960, would have loved to have handed off his Senate seat to his young brother. But unfortunately, his young brother, Ted Kennedy, was too young.
And so,
so as you well remember, they picked the auspicious Benjamin Smith II, who was JFK's college roommate, to be his
distinguished career as JFK's college
Not as distinguished as Benjamin Smith I, but we could talk about that some other time. And so Ted Kennedy finds himself running for the Senate in 1962 when he turns 30 years old, but he's up against Ed McCormick, who's the state attorney general and the nephew of Speaker of the House John McCormick.
And no mean character on his own right, and put up quite a fight. Remember what he had to say?
If his name was Edward Moore, with his qualifications, with your qualifications, Teddy, if it was Edward Moore, your candidacy would be a joke. But nobody's laughing.
Pretty strong stuff. And obviously, the voters were really affected by Ed McCormick's attack because Ted Kennedy won the primary 71-29.
It was an early case of right up in your face,
yeah.
But it didn't work. He tried very hard to turn Kennedy's extraordinary name recognition on its head. Didn't work.
And so you have, he's elected Senate that November against George Cabot Lodge, ironically the son of Henry Cabot Lodge, who JFK defeated in 1952.
Whom JFK defeated, and who, if I'm not mistaken, was the last Republican to take a Massachusetts seat away from a Democrat in 1946.
You're absolutely right. It has not happened since 1946 when Henry Cabot Lodge came back from World War II to defeat David Walsh, and not since then has a Republican taken a Democratic Senate seat away in Massachusetts. Okay, so Ted Kennedy is senator. So
his brother is the president, and his other brother, Bobby, is the attorney general.
Say it again. But then comes November 1963 and the shots in Dallas. And then then comes 1968 and the shots.
Well, wait a minute. Let's also remember 1964 when Bobby Kennedy made the shift from quitting the cabinet, by then LBJ's cabinet, to run for the Senate from New York.
Right.
And becoming a United States senator.
Along with
Teddy. Participating with Teddy. So at that point, we had two of the Kennedy brothers in the Senate at the same time. And they were there for the big year of 1965, passage of the Voting Rights Act, passage of Medicare, Medicaid, a number of other programs, the Great Society.
But and then came some bad years, and especially 1968 when we talked about earlier, we talked about the shots in Dallas. Now there were shots in Los Angeles. And Ted Kennedy now found himself as the not only the sole surviving Kennedy brother, but the object of all the people who wanted a Kennedy in the White House. They wanted Ted Kennedy to run. And there was a kind of a draft Kennedy move at the 68 Democratic Convention.
Even at that early time when he was at that point, what, about 36? He just 1 year over the constitutional requirement for age. And yet there were people who wanted to turn to him in the chaos, of course, of the downfall of LBJ, unhappiness with Hubert Humphrey as the nominee, all of the lost energy of the Gene McCarthy campaign and, of course, the Bobby Kennedy campaign. Those were dark days. And we should mention that thrown into the mix of all that was also the assassination of Martin Luther King in that April.
Right. But Ted Kennedy's star was on the ascendancy. The next year, early next year, he was elected Democratic Majority Whip. He defeated Russell Long. And then came the summer of 1969.
The summer of 1969, when in July, the Chappaquiddick incident resulted in the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, drowned in Ted Kennedy's car, or a car that Ted Kennedy had been driving off a bridge on Martha's Vineyard. His failure to report the accident immediately, I believe it was 9 hours before he went to the police, an incident for which many people have never forgiven Teddy Kennedy, and an incident which he has never really fully explained.
And so there was a lot of pressure on him to resign his Senate seat, and he addressed the people in Massachusetts in a statewide TV broadcast.
I do not seek to escape responsibility for my actions by placing the blame either on the physical and emotional trauma brought on by the accident or on anyone else. I regard as indefensible the fact that I did not report the accident to the police immediately.
Well, immediately is an interesting word there. Of course, you know, he left, as you say, for 9-10 hours, didn't report it for that long, and then went back to see if he could rescue Mary Jo Kopechne. Of course, it was far too late by then.
You know, maybe in a sense, Teddy Kennedy caught a break in that that awful incident happened the same week as the first moonwalk, the same week that the Apollo program landed Americans on the moon. That became the overarching news event of that month, and yet there never after that was quite the same inevitability or the same sense that this was eventually going to be a Democratic Party nominee for president.
Right. He still won re-election the following year in Massachusetts handily. I think it was like 67-68% of the vote. Democrats still wanted him to run for president in 1972. He said no. They still wanted him to run for president in 1976. He said no. And yet, ironically, the time he decided to run for president, 1979-1980, there was a Democrat in the White House, and with Jimmy Carter.
That's right. And Jimmy Carter was flailing in many respects. Bad economy, high unemployment, high interest rates. There was a great deal of conflict with Congress, particularly with the Senate. Didn't seem to understand that institution in which he had never served. And even though he had the breakthrough with respect to peace between Israel and Egypt, the rest of his foreign policy seemed to be hapless at many points. He seemed almost to be inviting a challenge from the left. But then when Ted Kennedy provided that challenge, things didn't go so well for his campaign either.
Exactly. And it started off so poorly. The famous or the infamous interview with CBS's Roger Mudd, when Roger Mudd asks a softball question, why do you want to be president? And Kennedy failed to come up with an articulate answer. He fumbled, and it was a memorable moment. I still remember watching that, saying there are so many reasons to take on Jimmy Carter. Why couldn't he enunciate any of them? It was a signal to me that perhaps Ted Kennedy had not thought this whole thing through.
And even when he did seem to start to get some traction as a candidate and get past that early Mudd interview, some of the things that afflicted Jimmy Carter, most particularly the taking of hostages in Tehran as part of the Iranian Revolution, that would seem to be a tremendous torpedo for any president's prestige and foreign policy going into his reelection campaign. And yet Carter managed to play that rather skillfully as a reason for him not to debate Teddy Kennedy. And that became very frustrating to the Kennedy campaign, that they were not able to really engage the incumbent in the crucial primaries early in 1980.
But as the year went on, I think people were getting more and more tired. The economy still showed no signs of pickup. And, of course, I remember when Andrew Young announced that he had had unauthorized meetings with the Palestine Liberation Organization. There was a big backlash in the Jewish community.
Andy Young was the ambassador to the United Nations,
right,
for Jimmy Carter.
And Ted Kennedy went on to win a big victory in New York. He wound up winning Pennsylvania. And I remember at the end of the primary season, he won California, but it was not enough to take the nomination away from the sitting president.
He had a great deal of momentum toward the end, and of course that carried him into the convention, where of course he didn't have the delegates to be nominated. Jimmy Carter was being renominated and wasn't that close, but Teddy Kennedy still had this sense that he had been in some measure vindicated in the primaries, and he gave, even in concession, the speech that many thought was the speech of his life.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
You know, what's so amazing about that speech, Ron, is that it was Jimmy Carter who was nominated for president. This should have been Jimmy Carter's crowning moment, and yet when I think of that convention in Madison Square Garden in New York in August of 1980, I think of that Ted Kennedy speech.
There was also the awful moment where Carter tried to get a arms raised, hatchet buried photograph opportunity with Teddy on the dais there with all the other Democratic leaders and with Jimmy Carter's running mate, Walter Mondale. And he had to pursue him physically, visibly around the dais, you know, darting in between various people because Kennedy didn't really want to be in that picture and eventually had to relent and be in it. That also was a wounding moment for Jimmy Carter. You know, if you're going to do the full catalog on Teddy Kennedy and the things that he did well and did badly and the effect that he had on American politics, I think you have to crank into that equation the effect that he had on Jimmy Carter's reelection prospects by running that strong campaign against him, obviously weakening him as a reelection candidate. And that led to the elevation that fall, 1980, to a highly significant Republican conservative figure.
Right, and that guy's name was Ronald Reagan. There are still some people, some Jimmy Carter loyalists, who say that Kennedy's challenge, Kennedy's behavior at the 80 convention perhaps contributed to Jimmy Carter's defeat that fall in a landslide to Ronald Reagan. I think Jimmy Carter had a lot to do with it myself. But while some people see that speech as Teddy Kennedy's finest moment, there are others who say that maybe one of his most selfish moments, and he helped bring his party down. I'm not one of those people.
All right, so once his presidential ambitions appeared to have finally been shelved, and he did have a couple of other opportunities to run later in the 1980s, could have run in 84, could have run in 88, he turned those down. He said he wasn't going to enter the fray, and he did not. For a period of time in the 1980s, well, he got a divorce in 1982. His personal life, if you will, deteriorated into a series of incidents that oftentimes were an embarrassment to him and to his legacy. But at the same time, he also gave a great deal more concentration to his work as a United States senator. And while he had always been a pretty effective legislator, even from his early days, he really began to build in the 1980s his legislation history and his reputation as a master legislator.
On labor policy, on children's policy, on policies that would help the poor, the underprivileged, his battle against Robert Bork, the nomination to the Supreme Court in 1987, from the outset, he was one of the earliest opponents, a more effective opponents, helped bring down the Bork nomination. But again, as you say, that there was still the carousing, that went on as late as 1991 when he was with his nephew, William Kennedy Smith, in Florida, when Smith was charged with rape. And of course, during the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, when Anita Hill was criticizing Clarence Thomas for disrespecting women, it was Ted Kennedy who, in any other time, would probably been able to stand up and be heard. But Kennedy's own reputation for how he treated women put him, I think, so much on the defensive that the strong role he played in bringing down Robert Bork was not available to him to do the same against Clarence Thomas.
He may have had other restraints, too, in not going after Clarence Thomas the way he went after Robert Bork. But it did come in the same year, 1991, as the notorious O'Barr incident in Florida. And it did weaken him, and he sat as, in a sense, a spiked siege gun on the Judiciary Committee during that entire proceeding. Interesting to note that he did play a role and did serve on the Judiciary Committee through the confirmation hearings of every member of the current Supreme Court except Sonia Sotomayor, whom he strongly supported and whom he would have obviously championed on the committee. But by then, his health no longer permitted him to participate, and he was not there for those proceedings this spring.
The diagnosis of terminal cancer was announced in May of 2008. I remember you and I, Ron, we were at the Democratic Convention in Denver. There were rumors that Ted Kennedy might appear, and of course he was so ill and so, I mean, he was suffering from kidney stones in addition to the brain cancer. And yet I remember when he showed up at that convention in 2008, there were chills.
It was a moving moment. And for those who were not present for some of his earlier speeches that will live in the annals, as it were, of convention oratory, at least they had a chance to hear him before he passed on and hear him give a speech that was reminiscent, used some of the language of those earlier speeches, particularly the 1980 speech. And if it wasn't the equal, it was certainly something that brought back those memories in strong form.
There is a new wave of change all around us. And if we set our compass true, we will reach our destination. Not merely victory for our party, but renewal for our nation. And this November, the torch will be passed again to a new generation of Americans. So with Barack Obama, and for you, and for me, our country will be committed to his cause. The work begins anew. The hope rises again, and the dream lives on.
Little reminiscence there, not only of his 1980 speech, but of his brother's inauguration speech in 1961.
The torch being passed to a new generation. So with Ted Kennedy now gone, obviously the question is now what happens to a successor. The state law in Massachusetts says that a special election needs to be held between 145 and 160 days after a Senate vacancy. That puts a special election into January. Democrats led by Governor Deval Patrick say they would love to change the rules.
Urged on by Teddy himself and his final days, this seems to have been his last official act.
That's
was to ask them to change that law.
Exactly, to say that, look, health care coming up, we need every vote we can. We only have 60 votes nominally you have 60 votes now with Kennedy's vote, with a vacancy for 5 months. Obviously, they would not have that. Massachusetts would go for a long time, as we just saw Minnesota going through, would go for a long time with only one senator. And so they would like to have an interim appointment, a caretaker appointment who would serve only until the special election, a person who would not run in that special election. Interestingly enough, of course, that was Massachusetts state law until 2004. The Democratic state legislature took away the power of appointment from the governor, because then John Kerry, who was running for president, there was a Republican governor, Mitt Romney, and Democrats didn't want to give Mitt Romney the appointment. So, of course, there's politics involved here. There's perhaps a hypocrisy. But the point is, it looks like there'll be a vacancy in the Senate for 5 months. And with so many crucial votes coming up, many people in Massachusetts feel that they cannot go 5 months with only one vote.
So as it stands now, as I understand it, Deval Patrick's in favor of it. We do not have commitments from the legislative leaders who have their own problems with this idea. So it's unclear, but it could not happen any sooner than the September weeks after Labor Day, because that's when the legislature comes back and Mitt Romney could laugh and point out the hypocrisy of the Democrats.
Mitt Romney actually was very emotionally moved by the passing of Edward Kennedy. Of course, Romney ran against Kennedy in 1994.
Ran a good campaign, too.
Good campaign, of course. And it was a Republican year, but, you know, you don't beat a Kennedy in Massachusetts. Mitt Romney learned that in 1994.
But back to the succession, there are a lot of people who are interested in that January 2010 election who don't want to make the pledge that if appointed in the interim, they would not run because they want to run. And that includes half the House delegation. A few have taken themselves out, but the rest of them want to be considered. You also have Martha Coakley, who is the Attorney General for Massachusetts. She looks like she might be a strong contender. And you have people talking about Mrs. Teddy Kennedy, Victoria Reggie Kennedy, who has avowed no interest, but who might get drafted into this.
Yeah, I don't think she runs, but one last word about Vicky Kennedy, though, that when you chronicle the life of Ted Kennedy, when he became an upstanding citizen, he was always an outstanding legislator, but an upstanding citizen, it seemed to coincide with his 1992 marriage to Vicky Reggie Kennedy. And she seems, you know, by all appearances, to have turned his life around, and a remarkable life it was.
Ken, there was other news this week besides the passing of Ted Kennedy. We had the president's decision to renominate Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, for another term, which sets up an entirely independent power base once this man has this renomination. He is, to a large degree, running the money supply, running the economy, enormously responsible for whether or not the economy comes back and Barack Obama's own political viability continues.
Well, you know, somebody told me, they said, Ken, if you vote for John McCain, we're going to wind up with Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense and Ben Bernanke running the economy. And I guess that's what happened.
One thing that happened that probably would not have happened under a President McCain, Eric Holder, the Attorney General under Barack Obama, decided to go forward with an investigation of some of the abuses of detainees and terror suspects under the Bush-Cheney administration run by the CIA.
It sounds like a decision that certainly displeased CIA Director Leon Panetta, who reportedly threatened to resign. Do you think, Ron, I'm just wondering, do you think that Holder's decision was a calculated thing, whereas Barack Obama could play the good cop and Holder plays the bad cop?
I think we could say that what Holder has shown here is the willingness to step out and take the heat and say, look, my president doesn't really want to go backward. He wants to go forward. But I think I've been shown too much in this Inspector General report that we have partially released about CIA abuses of detainees and suspects. I've been shown too much to just say, we're going to let this all go by. We have to have an investigation. We have to see whether or not people are going to need to be prosecuted for what look like crimes to the eye of an attorney general. And at the same time, he has also set up this new prosecutor to go forward with this. And he has a certain amount of independent streak. He has shown that in the past. I guess I come down on believing that Eric Holder made his own call here.
You know, it's funny, not too long ago, Dick Cheney was talking about we should release some of these old documents to show what the CIA actually did. Obviously, Dick Cheney was trying to make the case that it showed that these tactics worked. I suspect that what Eric Holder is about to release or has released is not what Dick Cheney had in mind.
Not exactly the same documents. It will be interesting to see over the course of probably many years how much of all of this comes out in the wash, how much we really do learn about whether or not unusual information, unique information was ever gained through these interrogations and what exactly they consisted of. But more on that in the future. Apparently, we're going to have more on several other controversies in the future. Ken, could we really be getting Rudy Giuliani to play with again?
Well, he says, I mean, apparently, according to a big New York Times article this week, it says that he looks like he's taking all the steps necessary to run for governor in 2010.
Yeah, but is he going to run? Is he really going to run?
I don't think he's going to run. I don't think he's willing to give up all those lucrative contracts and those speaking fees. And two, obviously one of the attractions of a Rudy Giuliani candidacy right now is that David Paterson looks so weak. But I don't think David Paterson is going to be the Democratic nominee for governor. I think it's going to be Andrew Cuomo. I know David Paterson made some big headlines this week by saying that it's a racial conspiracy out to get me from running. Regardless, look, is race involved? Perhaps. Is David Paterson's awful way of governing a factor? Yes. The point is, I don't think it's going to be David Paterson. It's going to be Andrew Cuomo. And ultimately, for that reason, or at least one of the reasons, that's why Rudy Giuliani does not run.
Also, we have a conflict between two sitting office holders of the same party in South Carolina, where Andre Bauer, the lieutenant governor, continues to express a preference for being governor and continues to express a preference for having the current governor, Mark Sanford, step down. That seems mysterious. Why would he want to have Mark Sanford step down and take over his job, Ken?
Well, you think that one of the reasons he'd want to do that is because not only he'd be the incumbent governor going to 2010, but he'd run for the office. But Andre Bauer said this week, in saying that Governor Sanford should step down, should resign his office, he says if the governor does so, I will not be a candidate in 2010. That was surprising as well.
So he's offering himself up as a placeholder, similar to this Massachusetts situation.
That's correct. But either way, Mark Sanford says, thanks, but no thanks, I'm not quitting.
What is Mark Sanford after at this point? His wife has apparently moved out of the governor's mansion, at least temporarily, taking their sons with her, and it's just not clear what he has to gain by staying in office.
You're not asking me to explain Mark Sanford's state of mind, are you, Ron?
Oh, of course I am. I think you could explain Mark Sanford's state of mind better than perhaps Mark Sanford himself.
Ron, and you know what that means.
That means that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
And may it be said of us, both in dark passages and in bright days, in the words of Tennyson that my brothers quoted and loved, and that have special meaning for me now, I am a part of all that I have met. Too much is taken, much abides. That which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.